You know, as I've done research and lived experience, it's been at least 20 years. And during that period of time, I've had a chance to work. Those of you know who Kenneth Ring is, this is his book, Heading Toward Omega. It was written quite some time ago. And I had a chance to go back and work with Kenneth Ring when he was still at the University of Connecticut. And I learned so many of the things that we shared. I mean, I have not had a near-death experience, kind of not. Not to the depth that Liz has, other than just being in the light for what I would consider to be seconds is all I experienced and never understood what it was until now. But I would like to take you on my journey in a way. One of the things that I highly recommend is so many of your questions relate to a book that I teach at a university. And I require all my students to read it because I teach psychology and because I want them to better understand themselves and how we develop. And it's a simple book to read. In fact, I have young people read it as well. It's called Bonds That Make Us Free by Terry Warner. I see a couple nods, but if you've never heard of it, Bonds That Make Us Free. One of the things I've learned and that correlates with the near-death experience is, and I love what Liz said, feelings are not truth. When the horse, the wild horse of emotion of jealousy, what other emotions? Hate, resentment, prejudice, any of these emotions are not truth. But feelings are real. The horse that's pulling you is real. And that is a powerful thing to understand about when you come back, as Liz said. Does she still get angry? Of course. As a mortal being, we have these feelings to rein them in, to look at them and find truth. If they aren't based upon truth, don't act on it. That's our biggest problem, is that we act on those feelings. I would like to share with you tonight, in fact, I just got this. This is so new. Those of you who know who Melvin Morse is, he's the pediatrician who, after reviving a number of children and them having near-death experiences, and he was kind of agnostic, borderline atheist, he was so incredibly mesmerized by this experience that he decided to do research in near-death experiences on children. And he still does this research today. He just spoke, and it's just 10 minutes long, about children having near-death experiences. And I asked Bob if he could arrange, I emailed him this information, and if he could arrange to put this 10 minutes on tape. So if you would bear with us, I'd like you to listen to Dr. Morse, and he's going to tell you some stories about children, and I think you'll enjoy it, okay?
We turn now to Dr. Melvin Morse, a pediatrician and consciousness researcher. He's author of several books, including Transformed by the Light. We asked him how he got interested in studying the phenomenon of near-death experiences in children all those years ago.
I was a critical care physician working out of Seattle Children's Hospital, primarily for Airlift Northwest, and we transported critically ill children from thousands of miles to Seattle, Washington. And frankly, at that time in my life, I never dreamed that anything happened when we die. I thought just when you died, you just sort of died. And I resuscitated a young boy, and he very dramatically opened his eyes, and he looked at me and he goes, "That was weird. You guys sucked me back into my body." And after he was successfully resuscitated, he had told us that during his resuscitation, he was floating out of his body and described his own resuscitation in great detail, and then said he saw a light that had a lot of good things in it. Coincidentally, or accidentally, I started hearing some of these stories from children. I decided that we would do our own study of it at Seattle Children's Hospital. And we studied all children who survived cardiac arrest over about a 15-year period. And we discovered that virtually all of them had this experience. One girl, she says to me, "I saw you put a tube in my nose, and I didn't like that. I didn't like what you were doing. And then told me that she had had the experience of going to a place that she thought was heaven. And it's, when you hear these experiences from children, it's extraordinary because they're so innocent about it. She goes, I wasn't dead at all. I was alive. You know, as if she could hardly believe it herself. I talked to one little girl along the same lines, and she said to me that when we resuscitated her, her grandmother was there with her. And then she goes, and then I was back. And I said, what do you mean you were back? And she goes, that's what I've been trying to figure out. So, you know, this is a sort of story that prompted me to want to study near-death experiences, particularly in children.
How do the reports differ between the younger children and then the teenagers?
Young children tell exactly what they see and hear. They don't tell a coherent story, but they tell little fragments of some sort of powerful experience they can hardly understand. They have a lot of memory gaps. They don't sew it together into a nice, pleasing story the way teenagers and adults do. So, for example, a typical child will say something like, I was in a tunnel. Well, maybe it was a noodle. Well, it's either a tunnel or a noodle, but it had a rainbow in it. And there was a honeybee, and I thought I was in heaven, and I know the bee liked me because he gave me some bread. You know, it's sort of, you know, these sort of odd little fragments. And then if you ask them any details of the fragments, they just go, I don't know, I don't know. So the children's, you know, the young children's experiences are primarily of this light and of just little tiny fragments of experiences. And then once you start talking to teenagers, they tell you much more involved stories. I was floating out of my body, I saw the doctors working on me, I went to a place I thought was heaven, and, you know, much more like adult stories.
When we spoke with Dr. Grayson, he suggested that one of the more interesting things about near-death experiences in adults is that very often it has a transformative effect on what these people do with their lives afterwards.
Yes.
Now, children don't have a lot of life experience beforehand, perhaps, particularly the youngest ones, but do you see the same kind of effect?
Absolutely. We studied adults who had near-death experiences as children. And we use the same protocol that Dr. von Lommel used in the Netherlands and when he studied the transformation in adults. And we compared these adults who had near-death experiences as children, we compared them to adults who had near-fatal events as children. We compared them to just ordinary adults that didn't have anything unusual happen to them. And then more importantly, we compare them to adults who had spiritual experiences as children, but not in the context of nearly dying. And we found a profound transformation occurred in adults who had near-death experiences as children. Specifically, here's the great secret of life, you know, is that they gave more money to charities than our control populations. They ate more fresh fruits and vegetables. They spent more time with their families. They spent more time alone in meditation or in solitary pursuits. They had a greater understanding of how all of life is interconnected. They had very little death anxiety. In other words, they weren't afraid to die. And they had an unusual zest for living. And we documented all of this with various psychiatric and psychological tests. And we were able to show that this transformation is very real. And so that's another piece of evidence that the experience itself is real. Because we wouldn't expect, for example, that a lack of oxygen to your brain causing a hallucination would then cause a lifelong transformation.
Dr. Melvin Morse, for a lot of the people who are listening to your voice and who are having real trouble grappling with this notion of consciousness and an experience after death, I'd like you to share some of the stories that you have come in contact with regarding young children and their observation of what happens when they die. And I guess what I mean by that is you have related to us in the past situations with a crash cart, as I recall, that was unplugged and didn't work. You've dealt with children who have drowned, and then their eyes are closed, they're comatose, they're not breathing, there's cardiac arrest, and yet somehow they are observing things that can be documented in that emergency department. Can you share some of those stories, please?
Thank you so much. Anyone who is having difficulty understanding this, I sympathize with you. It's taken me 20 years to understand it. And when I first started to hear these stories from children, I laughed. I started, this one girl told me that after giving a detailed description of her own resuscitation, in which she would say things like, I saw you go over to the phone, and then you talked to some other doctor and said, what am I supposed to do next? And then I heard one of the nurses talk about her cat, and that her cat was going to have to go to the hospital. And then everybody took me into another room where there's a machine that looked like a donut. And then she told me she went to this heavenly realm, and when she saw the obvious disbelief on my face, she reached over and patted my hand, and she goes, you'll see, Dr. Morse. Heaven is fun. So this is, it's very hard to understand this. I have to tell you, one teenage boy that we worked on to resuscitate him, afterwards, after he was successfully resuscitated, I was talking to him, and I said to him, I made reference to that we had saved his life. And he looked at me and he said, no, you didn't. He said, your crash cart wasn't plugged in. He said, when I was floating on the ceiling, I looked down and I saw that it wasn't plugged in at all. And that's why you guys are having trouble getting it to work. And he was absolutely right. We had been having trouble getting it to work. And in the hubbub of resuscitation and such as that, somebody had kicked the plug, free from the wall. So they get all of these little details correct about their own resuscitation.
Now, of course, a lot of people say, well, it's obviously not a dying brain. It's a process. And you have to tell our listeners that when you talk about resuscitation, these are children who, I presume, have cardiac arrest. There is no heartbeat, and who are not breathing on their own, and presumably who would be flatlined if you put an EEG on them. That is to say, the brain would not be demonstrating electrical activity.
One reason that I've gone into this research full time is I feel a tremendous obligation to share with people what I know. Because your question is essentially, were these children truly near death? And the advantage of being a critical care physician is, yes, these children were by any criteria not just near death, but were dead. These are children that were underwater for 19 minutes, underwater for 45 minutes. They're truly extraordinary resuscitations. We defined as near death only children who truly are at the point of death. Their pupils are fixed and dilated. They're not breathing on their own. And I don't have to rely on medical records or the reports from other people. These are children I resuscitated myself or my partners did.
Dr. Melvin Morse, we want to thank you very much for talking with us on the People's Pharmacy today.
Oh, it's my great pleasure. Thank you.
Dr. Melvin Morse is a pediatrician and consciousness researcher. He's author of several books, including Closer to the Light, Transformed by the Light, and Parting Visions.
All wonderful books. Absolutely fantastic. So, any questions just from what you heard? Should anybody? Well, oh, I shouldn't say that because he'll get mad at me because you don't get to get hooked up. Let me explain to you a couple of things. One third of adults who die and are resuscitated. Oh, music background. One third of adults who are resuscitated have near-death experiences. Dr. Moore said all children who have cardiac arrest that he interviewed, and they have been many, all have had near-death experiences. I think that's an example of exactly what I said about being prepared, being open to experience that, I think is phenomenal. Since you're all here, if something happens, we're probably more likely to have a near-death experience. Do you know that? In my opinion, because you are receptive to that other realm. And I think that's awesome. One of the things I wanted to share with you, the last thing, we have just enough time, probably one of the most beautiful near-death experiences. In fact, Kenneth Ring said, of all the near-death experiences he'd ever heard, this one was, for him, one of the most powerful. And the reason I'm going to read this to you is because it is about a child. And the most important thing I want you to understand is, for those of you who've lost someone that you ache so much to be near and to see again, this really gives you, I think this story gives such great peace and understanding. And so, may I? Please forgive me for reading, but I don't want to tell it. I want to tell it in her words. Dr. Kenneth Ring is the one starting out. Since 1976, when I began my work in near-death studies, I've been the recipient of many hundreds of letters from people interested in NDEs and related experience. In many of these correspondence, they would describe their own experiences. For reasons you can now well understand, most of the accounts I read with deep absorption and appreciation. Of all the beautiful letters I have received, however, I think the one that touched me the most profoundly was written by a woman, now 51. Now remember, this was some time ago, who resides with her family in the Midwest. I've never met her, but for a long time I've kept her letter in a special file in my private study because for reasons I myself don't fully understand, I particularly treasure it. In July 1981, four NDEers and I appeared on the Donahue Show, and Anne happened to see it. Doing so prompted her to write the following letter. I watched you on the Donahue Show today with a great deal of interest because I am also one of those people who have experienced the peace and absolute love of the spiritual existence. By the way, for those of you who don't know who Donahue is a white male Oprah. Right? Am I correct? Thank you. Okay. I volunteer my own experience to your study because, in addition to creating a total change in my personality, I was given information that literally saved me from suffering the terrible grief of the death of my husband and two children later on. I was 22 years old, delivering my second child, a little girl. The date was June 18th, 1954. I began to hemorrhage badly, I'm told, but I recall a great pain in my chest that was making it impossible for me to draw in more air after exhaling. I recall a sense of being pulled up, not down, by some great force out of the room toward a bright light, which seemed far away at first, but I flew toward it very swiftly. The pain fell behind me like ribbons or streamers trailing me, as I knew I was going faster and faster. The light appeared to be a window of some kind, and I was momentarily alarmed that I would be hurt as I crashed into it, because I could not possibly stop myself in time at such high speed. I automatically shut my eyes and braced myself for the crash, which was unavoidable, I thought. Nothing crashed. I suddenly stopped and felt myself lying perfectly still, like floating on water. My sense of belonging, love, peace, and well-being was indescribable, ineffable. It was absolute, perfect, wonderful. I didn't know where I was, but I didn't care. I would be content to stay there forever. I was alone, but not lonely. Even though there was no visual means of determining my position in this environment of nothing, I knew I was lying down rather than standing up. Then I received the knowledge. No one was there with me, and no one spoke as we speak, that I was to wait there until a person came to talk to me. Then I knew he was on his way toward me from an unthinkable distance away. He, rather than she, came to me at an unthinkably high speed, passing through the universe, through whole galaxies to come to where I was. I was in a world, a huge world, of total nothingness except myself. The bright light I had seen at first as a window in the world of total darkness was all about me now, but not bright anymore, soft now and soothing, or perhaps no light at all and no darkness either. More a haze. I felt so very, very comfortable there. I sensed this person's approach toward me, and I knew, and she has quotes whenever she says knew, I knew the exact instant he entered into the outer edge of the world or state of awareness that I was in. He came to me from my right-hand side. In a matter of seconds, he entered my world, hundreds and thousands of light years away, the edge of it, I mean, and traveled to my side by the way he was standing and took hold of my right hand. When he took hold of my hand, I immediately knew him to be the greatest friend I had. I also knew that I was a very special person to him. The thrill of his touch of hands exceeds anything I have ever experienced on earth or in life as we know it. Our meeting was understood, sensed, not visual. Without vocal communication, he told me he had come for my child. My child, I asked, scarcely able to contain my joy and happiness over the news that one of my own children would be going back with him. It was, I knew, a very high honor to be selected for this. I had the honor of being the mother of a very extra special child, and I was so proud that he had picked my child. We were discussing her life, not death. It was a fantastic opportunity for my child, and it never occurred to me to refuse to give my child to this man. Thus, I gave my child to him, or I meant to do so immediately, but I could not do this because I then realized with great disappointment my child was not with me. I had no child to give him. I started to cry over the loss of such a great opportunity as this. No child to give. I was a mother with no child. It seemed such a terrible thing to have no child to give to this man. I was about to be devastated by my own sorrow over such a great loss of this wonderful opportunity for my child. If I had a child right then to give him, but I didn't. And I didn't know why I didn't, because I knew I was a mother. He patted my hand in sympathy and reassured me that I was a mother. And I did have a child, but the child must have been delayed somehow. Then he waved his hand across the space in front of us, and the haze cleared. I could see the nurses and doctor and my baby back in the delivery room. The doctor was examining the baby and laying it on a scale-like machine, which was supposed to indicate its lifespan rather than weight. We could see that the machine was malfunctioning and giving the doctor a false reading. The doctor gave the baby to the nurse, saying it would live 80 years. But the man with me is shaking his head, saying to me, men put so much faith in their own machines, they fail to notice the truth. The machine is wrong. The child will only live 4 days. Would my child live 80 years if the machine was fixed? I asked. Yes. But they don't know that it is not working properly. Then I'll tell them. When I go back, I'll tell them. No, you won't remember any of this when you go back. Then I don't want to go back. I want to go with you. No, I came for the child. It is not time for you to come with me now. You must go back. But what about my child now? I will return for your child in 4 days. And this statement filled me with joy again. With this promise, I was willing to go back. I was perfectly willing to go back and wait for my own turn while my child went first. I had not seen, as we see here on earth, or held this child in my arms yet, but I felt such an overwhelming love for this child. I would have sacrificed anything for her. Going back was a sacrifice, or so it seemed to me then. I'm going to tell them about that faulty machine when I go back. You won't remember. I will. I must. Most people never remember this place when they go back. Even if you do, they won't believe you. It is probably best that you don't remember rather than be disbelieved. No, I will remember. Whether anyone believes me or not doesn't matter. I must remember this place. He let go of my hand, and I felt myself falling away from him, moving downward quite fast, looking back to where he was, saying over and over, "I'll remember, I'll remember, I must remember this place." Then someone was screaming my name and slapping my face on the cheeks both back and forth. And I was still concentrating so hard on what I intended to remember that I didn't answer to my name being called. I knew I was back in the delivery room now and fully aware of the nurse bending over me, slapping my cheeks and calling me by name. But if I answered, I'd forget what I was trying so hard to remember. Somehow I knew that if I answered her, I'd forget everything. So I didn't answer. Deliberately didn't answer her. Then she said, "Your baby is here." And that caught me off guard. I wanted to see my baby just once before she left me. I answered, "But I must remember," which made no sense to her, she said later. In that instance, my speaking to her, I totally forgot it all. I wanted to see my baby. Anne's letter continues with a description of her next few days in the hospital. Her own situation, she discovered, had indeed been critical. But the outcome for both mother and child, she did give birth to a daughter, Tari was her name, or they named her, appeared positive. Nevertheless, she continued to feel that there was something she was supposed to tell her physician about a baby, but simply could not remember it. On the second day, her physician detected severe cerebral hemorrhaging in the baby, who was now paralyzed on her right side, and he knew, according to what he later told Anne, that she would probably die. He tried to prepare Anne for the news, but did so in a gentle, indirect manner. Nevertheless, at this point, Anne was totally unconcerned about her baby's state of health. Anne's now speaking. "I persisted in concentrating on some elusive thing that I was supposed to remember to tell him. Still, I heard and understood all that he said to me. What I failed to do was feel worried about it, or frightened, or sad. That sense of peace and well-being seemed to come back with me. Though I remembered nothing and could not explain why, I was not worried about my baby daughter and how I knew she was going to be all right. It was contrary to the physical facts." Now, on the morning of the fourth day, June 22nd, Tari died. That morning, Anne writes, she woke up suddenly, fully alert. "I sensed something had happened to me, but I didn't know what it was." Because her physician had noted her strangely serene attitude about Tari's impending death, he had given the staff strict orders that none of them should break the news to Anne. He himself would do it. It didn't work out that way. Anne found herself ready to be discharged. She was explaining to one of the nurses that she had to sign certain papers first when it was apparent that the nurse was devastated. "She knew Tari was dead, and I didn't," was what the nurse thought. "Oh, God," she wailed. "Your doctor should have been here by now. I'm not supposed to tell you, but I can't let you go on believing Tari is alive. She died early this morning." In the time it took her to get up from her desk and come to me, taking hold of my shoulders, I completely remembered it all in detail. Relived it. Almost. "I suppose I look strange," to the nurse. "Are you okay?" she asked. "Yes," I told her, much too calmly under the circumstances. "This is the fourth day," I said, and I felt joy. In the weeks following, I felt no grief of my own loss, but I felt sorry for my friends and relatives who didn't know where Tari was and couldn't believe, really believe, that my experience was anything more than a vivid dream. Her husband and her doctors were other patients who experienced NDEs, though they were not, of course, called that in 1954, did acknowledge, however, that something real had happened to Anne, but not so her minister, who, here's what he said, pronounced this experience as a hallucination common to persons undergoing great stress. "There was no such thing as leaving this life, going to another, and coming back here again. It was a psychological defense mechanism," he said, "and I would be better off to simply forget all about it, so that my natural grief period could begin and be gone through, so that my life could get back to normal again." This conversation with my minister almost wiped me out, but I obeyed him without question. Or I tried to. At least, in a matter of months, I had not been able to forget it. And I was well on my way to thinking myself to be some kind of freak. It would have been easier, I think, to forget my own name than to forget that wonderful feeling, surge of sheer joy I felt when he took my hand and told me he had come for my child. That was the greatest moment I've ever known. I still don't know who he was, nor do I care. I know he exists, at least. Well, I soon realized that my acceptance back into this world depended on pretending to forget and pretending to grieve the loss of my baby. So I did this for everybody else's sake, except my husband, who believed me and gained some comfort from it secondhand. He was a dropped subject, but never forgotten. Anne concluded her letter by saying, "So you know, I listened very intently to the people you appeared with on the Donahue show, of course. I don't simply believe they had some kind of real experience. I know they did. It all rang so true to me, and I also understand the terrible difficulty in trying to verbalize it afterwards in a way that others can believe it too. You have to water it down so much. I have not been very successful at this. Thank you for listening." She added a postscript. "I had 3 more children after Tari's birth. My beloved husband died in my arms at home 16 years later. My firstborn son lived to be 25 and was killed in a car accident. Instantly, no time for pain or suffering. This happened seven years after the death of my husband. My grief was softened and shortened each time. People said, 'She's in shock now. She'll grieve more later.' Later, they said, 'She must be a very strong person to live through what she's had to live through so calmly.' Neither statement was true. It feels good to tell the truth to someone. They aren't dead. They're all alive, busy, and waiting for me. Our separation is only temporary and very short compared to all of eternity." If nothing in life gives you hope, I think that our special speaker tonight, that wonderful NDE that we just heard, isn't that beautiful? Near-death experiences are gifts, and I am so grateful for those who are willing to share their spiritual experiences, their growth, and then the near-death experience. It helps us to grow. I hope you come back next month. Oh, I have only one thing to share that really impressed me when you asked the question about or talked about love. One reason I talked to you about getting that book, Bonds That Make Us Free, is I think that second to, for me, the scriptures, I don't think there is a book other than near-death experience stories that have changed my life so profoundly as Bonds That Make Us Free, because it answered for me the question you have about love. And I'd like to just succinctly tell you what I learned. Loving another and understanding what they have been through does not mean that they do not have to pay the consequences of what they choose to do in life. And sometimes we think of love as laying down and letting people walk on us. That is not the case, and I think Liz alluded to that. Loving another sometimes means saying, "Get off your duff and get to work." Sometimes it means saying, "Come here and let me hold you in my arms while you cry." To learn the difference is what is so important. How to genuinely love. Sometimes we want the other to love us so bad that we are not willing to do the loving thing. In The Road Less Traveled, I love a statement that Scott Peck is an awesome author. If you haven't read The Road Less Traveled, how many of you have read it? It's been around for like 20 years. There's another book that he wrote, The Road Beyond, I think it's called. Anyway, in his book he says that genuine love is doing that which will bring about the spiritual growth of the other. Do you get that? Genuine love is doing that which will bring about the spiritual growth of the other. And sometimes that means doing and saying those things that might be difficult, painful, and forgetting about you because you care more about them. Does that help to understand? You got to get that book, Bonds That Make Us Free. It's one of the most profound books, and I think the greatest gift that I learned from it is there is no answer. Every moment you meet someone, they invite you to love them as they're needed to be loved. It is not a formula. There is no formula. The formula is being open to what I consider to be spiritual promptings. And I think that's a good way of putting it. I hope you've enjoyed tonight. I'm not going to keep you another second. Thank you for not going to sleep, at least most of you. Thank you again. I hope you enjoyed it. Come back next month, same time, same station.